This is Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
JBL Tour Pro 3 earbuds are for those who don't conform to the standard.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to get into some touchscreen technology, how about the smart charging case, clear sound? These are not standard things. You're only going to get them with the JBL Tour Pro 3, baby.
And I love the sound of JBL when it goes... These earbuds are packed with innovation because you can't stand out by following others.
Touchscreen smart charging case for one-touch control, instant EQ customization, true adaptive noise canceling, and the one-of-a-kind audio transmitter, which can plug and play with everything from game consoles to in-flight entertainment. What more could you want? First doesn't follow. Grab a pair at JBL.com.
This is CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. To Israel, to the report of a red line painted around the Supreme Court building and protesters wearing red, making demands upon the government of Benjamin Netanyahu, this turns on the issue of the powers of the Supreme Court in Israeli governance. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, who teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, and has written on this issue in the Wall Street Journal op-ed page some weeks past. However, the protests continue to grow, so the puzzle is, what is the way forward for the government led by Mr. Netanyahu and for the protesters, who resemble very much political actors, not legal scholars? Professor, a very good evening to you. As I understand it from your column earlier in the Wall Street Journal, the Israeli Supreme Court has powers quite in excess or quite different than the U.S. Supreme Court. How so? Good evening to you.
Yes, I mean, the Israeli Supreme Court basically stands out as the most powerful judicial body anywhere throughout the Western world. And it's manifested in several ways. One is there's a critical question of how it is that people are appointed to the Supreme Court. And back in the 1950s, long before the Israeli Supreme Court took upon itself the role of creating a constitution out of whole cloth, what they did is they had a panel of nine people, which consisted of three Supreme Court justices, several lawyers, and several people from other branches of government. And it needed seven to get somebody appointed to the Supreme Court. And since there were three judges, the judges could, in effect, block anybody being appointed to replace a Supreme Court justice who retired or died, right? An extraordinary type situation. To make it even more complicated, the three Supreme Court justices were usually appointed by the chief and essentially always voted as a block. So it wasn't a question that it would be 2-1 in either direction. And so the source of the criticism is you cannot have a body which is de facto self-perpetuating. And what you have to do is to change the way in which this is done. Now, there's no obvious way into which you change it. You could expand the size of the particular body. You could require that the members of the Supreme Court who are appointed to this particular body are chosen by lot rather than by the Chief Justice, or so that they don't act in unison. There's just a lot of things that you can do. But I think if you were to come to the United States and put the power in place, Joe Biden has announced that he would like to appoint Ms. Ketanji Jackson to the United States Supreme Court. And the Chief Justice now has a committee of three people, and they basically block us because they think she's too far to the left. Now, we would never tolerate that in this country. And essentially, the conservative position is that the meaning of the phrase independence of the justices is once they're appointed, you're not supposed to tamper with them, to influence them, to bribe them, to threaten them, and so forth. But it doesn't mean that the political parties of the government have no role in their selection. And in Israel, the independence of the judiciary is taken to mean both. Is it's a self-perpetuating on the one hand, and then free from the ordinary political influences. So this is a huge difference. A second major difference is in the United States, the Supreme Court has developed a series of doctrines which are intended to limit its own power. So there's something most notably called the political question doctrine, which says that certain kinds of issues are reserved exclusively to the legislative and the executive branch of the government, having to do with war and peace and major commitments overseas. And they simply will not get involved in those kinds of questions. In Israel, there is no such thing as the political question doctrine. So essentially, the Supreme Court can intervene in any kind of dispute, including delicate trade negotiations that the political sovereigns or the political branches are entering into foreign governments. And as best one can tell, the only standard that is used to decide this is a standard of reasonableness, not fleshed out in any detailed way, which means that the justices, if they are so inclined, have virtually arbitrary power to veto certain kinds of very important deals. The Israeli system also gives extraordinary powers to the attorney general, who's the only person in the government who's allowed to represent it legally. So there are no independent sources of power in the various agencies the way it is in the United States. So when I first got involved in this situation, when I joined a situation called the Israeli Committee on Law and Liberty, I was asked to head their foreign board. I actually tried to sit down and learn all this stuff. I read an extraordinary article by a man named Yonatan Green, who at that time was with this organization, sort of outlining this. And to me, the only question there was how do you, A, politically get the will to execute the change, and B, what's the change that you want to make? The sticking point in the press has not been the two things that I've just mentioned. They are rarely discussed. It has rather been the question as to whether there's a political override of a constitutional decision made by the Supreme Court of Israel. And the Supreme Court of Israel doesn't get its power to override from anything other than its own decisions. And so the theory is, at least in some cases, there has to be a political check the way there is, for example, in Canada. They proposed a simple majority. That may be difficult to get. It's not as easy as it sounds, particularly since the body that's going to have to vote on the constitutionality of this law, it may not be the same group that put it into effect some years earlier. You could change that a little bit, make it 55% instead of 50%. And so in the Knesset, you need 66 members instead of 60 to be able to do this. There are a lot of grounds on which you could find compromise. So what I find so crazy is you see the red line and just downright hysterical statement. I mean, some amongst the most irresponsible of the American columnists is Thomas Friedman, you know, who compares Netanyahu to Mr. Putin for trying to institute a set of reforms that actually makes some sense. And what happens is typically the critics of the Netanyahu just simply say that the democratic balance is necessarily at stake, when in fact what they're doing is they're defending a judicial oligarchy which needs some degree of political discipline and correction. But what's really going on is it's part of a larger battle over the question of whether or not Israel will move conservative. And it's been 20 years since they've had a Labor Party prime minister and so forth. And it seems pretty clear that given the terrible situation with Iran and the constant drain of the Palestinian situation, the Israelis have become much more conservative than they had previously been.
So we can regard this contest then chiefly as political. That's what you're
yeah, I mean, it's
to.
Clearly it is. What's happened is the Israeli Progressive Party says we've lost the political branches of government.
There were five elections and they could not prevail.
And they won't prevail. The reason they won't prevail is there's no such thing as a two-state solution. I mean, Netanyahu's of the opinion, I don't agree with him, that pulling out of Gaza was an unmitigated disaster. But I certainly would agree with him if the Israelis were to pull out of the West Bank, turn it over to Palestinian control, they would then invite several, a quarter of a million of Iranian soldiers to sit on the Israeli building border and be totally untenable. The only status quo that's stable in Israel is the current status quo. There will be no two-state solution whatsoever because there's nobody whom you can trust to make the
deal. And those are political events that are decided at the ballot box. Richard, when you wrote about this some weeks ago, you convinced me completely when you quoted Justice John Marshall. That was it. May I repeat what you write in the Wall Street Journal? In Marbury versus Madison, Justice John Marshall explained that, quote, it is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is, end quote, and not what it ought to be. That established the basis for the credibility of the United States Supreme Court.
If you're a judicial body and you announce that you believe in judicial realism so that every decision you make is going to be as good as any other decision you make when it comes to text and history and so forth, what you've done is you forfeited any claim to legitimacy. And that's been the force of the originalist movement, which I think is wrong in many of its details and so forth. But it does recognize the simple point that you can't treat a constitution as an empty vessel into which you could pour any fluid that you start to want. And the Israeli Supreme Court does just that.
And the offered compromise still turns on the fact that the Supreme Court in Israel is both the advocate, the investigator, and the judge, all in one package. And that strikes me as obviously distorted. It turns on an episode that I'm not entirely familiar with, but I believe it's because Mr. Netanyahu is accused of accepting a bribe because a newspaper wrote a favorable article about him. It is that fantastic, isn't it, Richard?
Yes. What happens is that's something else that takes place. If you wish to dislocate somebody from the political process, what you do is you institute a criminal prosecution against them. And that can be done by a highly independent attorney general on the worst of information. Now, the analogous situation is, you know, Mr. Bragg going after Donald Trump for all of the campaign contributions he made to Stormy Daniels in order to suppress his affairs with her of one kind or another. Well, I mean, my view about it is that the use of the criminal process to deal with major political figures is fraught with risk. And if retaliation takes place, it's going to be a total disaster. So I think Joe Biden has done many terrible things, but I'm not in favor of criminal prosecution for any of them. That's not true with respect to his son, Hunter, probably does commit some serious crimes that deserve jail time or something of the sort. But that's part of the Israeli system, because what they do is this is a area which absolutely requires some degree of negotiation, diplomacy, and compromise. And you see these red lines drawn and these semi-hysterical statements made by people who absolutely know that the current system in Israel is completely untenable. And what they are doing is trying to defend it solely to defame Mr. Netanyahu. Fortunately, there seem to be some quiet negotiations going on out of the battlefield in which Netanyahu has indicated his willingness to compromise on some of these issues. And now the question is to get the other people to go along. What's hard is if you're trying to figure out how to run a judicial nomination process, the simple observation you make is when Supreme Courts are not particularly powerful, what happens is nobody cares all that much, and so it's easy to get compromised. But the moment these offices have enormous influence, as they do both in Israel and in the United States, then all sorts of hell will break loose in the operation of the appointments process, no matter what the rules are. Just think of what happened to Bob Bork and to Clarence Thomas and to Justice Kavanaugh and so forth. You go to the mat. And in American politics today, if you are right into your fingers, there's no compunction for you to pull out all the stops. And that's exactly what's happening in Israel. What we really need is for the left to back up. I think the administration's on the other side. The groups that I have worked with have always said that we know the current situation is broken, but we're less confident in the way in which we think this ought to talk out. And so let's listen to people who kind of describe it. But Israel is in a very odd position where they have to move away from the status quo. I think that's true. And the people who are opposing any judicial change are pretending that the current situation is consistent with democratic principles. All bizarre.
And what we can say right now is Israel is showing us an example of a state where politics is carried through into the media and then carried through into demonstrations like this red line or wearing costumes.
That's right. And I mean, self-destructive, encouraging foreign countries not to invest in Israel, encouraging people to leave the military when they have these huge problems very elsewhere. The whole thing has become grotesque. This should be a very difficult issue meant to have low-level, serious deliberation. And from the beginning, the attack on it has been any change is going to be sacrilege, when in fact everybody knows that change is a necessity.
I make that observation because I want to move to a case where I see the law caught up in a political event. This is at the Stanford campus, something you're very familiar with as a member of the Hoover Institution. So we're going to turn to what we understand so far about Stanford Law School's troubles. Richard Epstein is a professor of law at NYU and the University of Chicago. He is also a senior fellow of the Hoover Institution. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Mack.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.